The wind whistles up from the foil on a wintry day in Derry. I've come to visit the Playhouse, the biggest community arts centre in Northern Ireland, to find out how the arts can be used to help people deal with the legacy of the conflict. Pauline Ross is the centre's founder and director.
Our strapline, if you like, is arts and the community working together. The whole impetus of setting up the Playhouse was as a place where people could be creative, a place that would support emerging artists, be they writers, dancers, playwrights or young actors, and that we would create a community art service literally from the creche right through to our senior citizens and everything else in between.
The Playhouse belongs to an international network of artists from areas of conflict around the world that work with communities to explore social and political issues. In 2009, the centre brought to Derry an innovative form of theatre known as Theatre of Witness.
Theatre Witness is a form of theatre that was devised by a woman in America, in Philadelphia, Tea Sepinok. And she devised it primarily to work within the prison system. And she would have worked in death row in that. And she had the opportunity at times through her work to bring perpetrators and their victims together for healing. When I heard of her work, I thought, I think this could work within the Northern Irish situation. So I invited her over and I set up interviews with people. And, you know, there is a need for people to be understood. There is a need, particularly for victims and survivors, to tell their story. And right across the globe, any of the other practitioners I talk to, this is constant. I need to tell my story and I need to know why. It's universal. If something has happened or a tragedy or a loss, they want to tell their story, but they also want to find out why. So her work, I felt, in a very gentle way, excavated the truths and the stories. It's a long process. It takes about a year to do a production. So the stories are gathered and the consent, obviously, of the bearers of their stories, because they become the performers. This is not about taking a story, scripting it and handing it to an actor. They, through a long process of rehearsal and preparation, they then go on stage.
I walk around this city. I walk the walls and the streets. And I still see the battles that we fought. The bullet holes in the walls. I hear the screams. Smell the CS gas. Sometimes it feels like it was all just yesterday. If it hadn't been for this conflict, what was your potential? I remember so many of them as great footballers, mechanics, artists, so talented. But it's all locked down there now without an avenue. What was useful in these guys has been used up. The war used it up. Prison used it up. And drink used it up. I see it in their eyes. Flashes of stories that can't be told. Ghosts.
What you have the opportunity to do with all the arts, be it the visual arts or moving images or theatre in particular that I'm interested in, is you can present to communities their lives, their stories, the truth, and that audiences can come and bear witness to that.
It was the height of the Troubles. The father was talking about how the IRA were starting up again. Back home, the violence and rioting had intensified. There were barricades everywhere. The UDA at that time was like a neighbourhood watch, a defence organisation. A defence organisation that needed a continuing supply of young people. We're oppressed. If we don't stand up for ourselves, we'll be trampled under the ground. If they're not for you, they're against you, they'd say. So then somebody says, well, let's join up then.
The cast for the first Theatre of Witness production, We Carried Your Secrets, included Republican and Loyalist ex-combatants, a serving member of the security forces, and a number of people from the next generation who were also affected by the Troubles. Singer Victoria Geelan, daughter of a retired RUC officer, was one of the younger performers on stage.
My name is Victoria Geelan. I'm originally from Omagh in County Tyrone. I'm 28 years old and I now live here in Derry City. I have been singing professionally on and off for the last 7 years. I studied modern languages, French and Spanish, over in Newcastle upon Tyne. And immediately after that, I actually moved back to Derry. And I had never lived in Derry before. And it was in Derry here that I got my education. It was in May 2008, and at the time I was in a band called Mantic. I had joined them in the January, and we were due to go into the studio in May. And I attended an event called Chicken Soup for the Soul, which was a storytelling event, and there were three people speaking at that event, and I went along because there was free soup. People were talking about their stories, and they weren't all related to the troubles. They were just talking about, you know, things that had happened in their lives. But all three of them were over 50, and at that time, I was writing lyrics for songs for the album. And I was thinking very much about, you know, what can I say? And the fear of saying something that might infuriate or, you know, cause hurt to anyone or cause hurt to me because of people's actions that could happen as a result. So at the end, there was a question and answer session, and I got up and I made the same comment about how all the storytellers were over 50. And my question was, when does your story count? When are you old enough to have a story? And how much do you have to suffer before you have a story? And at that point then, or later after the question-answer session, Taya Sepinuk, the director of Theatre of Witness, came over to me and asked if she could meet me to discuss a theatre project that she was exploring at the time. Compared to so many others in Omagh and Northern Ireland and the rest of the world, I haven't suffered. I have no tragic story. But why do we feel the need to judge and compare our experiences? Why do we measure who has suffered the most? Not one of us who has lived through the violence here has been left unscathed. We all have our scars, seen and invisible. I was born in the middle of the Troubles. We've been carrying the secrets of those who came before us ever since we were born. Well, one or two I already knew. In fact, Finbar, the drummer in that performance, was the drummer in the band that I was in at the time. So when I was speaking to Taya in my initial meeting with her in May 2008, I was talking about how I wanted to go. I was having conversations with the drummer in the band, and he came from a very different background than I did. My father was in the RUC, and his father had been murdered because he was a Sinn Féin councillor. And so very early on in meeting the band in January, because I auditioned for the band, and then within a week or so, Finbar himself volunteered the information, going, listen, a couple of lads in the band are worried that I might say or do something to offend you, and what you need to know is my dad was shot when I was five, and he was a Sinn Féin councillor. He wasn't in the IRA or anything, but that's what happened, and I need you to know that. And at that time, he didn't know that my father was in the RUC or had been in the RUC because he's now retired. I don't think I could have done this had he still been working. It wouldn't have been possible. But I knew then that I had to tell him so that we had trust, because you can't have creative relationships if there isn't trust. So in March, I then found an opportunity. I'd already spoken to the band members, going, right, I need to tell them this. And they're like, yeah, you do. And we'll help you. We'll make it safe for you to do so, don't worry. because I didn't know how I was going to react. And then so I told him in March, and he later told me it was the worst thing I could have told him. At that time, he was actually dealing on his own with the inquiry into his father's murder, and he was 23. So we had long conversations into the nights. Because it was so much at the forefront of my mind when I was going to write the lyrics and we were going into the studio, and, you know, the pressure was on. And so I mentioned to Taya about him, and she said she'd like to meet him. So I asked him if he'd be willing to meet her. He said yes. They met up, and eventually he also was in the project. So that was our history.
He walks to just 12 inches away and calls out Bernard. Then he fires 8 shots from a 22 before fading back into the crowd. My dad's done. He was on his way to work in the morning, but he told my uncle after the football that he knew he was being followed every day. The UFF claimed the murder. He was shot with a .22 pistol. He was found in a car the following February, but the man was never arrested. No one's ever been arrested or questioned for it. Police had photo kits. One was given by the woman in the bus next to the car my dad was shot in, but it was never shown to the public. 2 witness statements were taken. A third one, the guy says he's willing to come forward and give his again, because at the barracks, the police tried to politely talk him out of it. His statement isn't even on record. None of the descriptions were shown outside the barracks, and the ombudsman's told us that there may not even be an investigation file. Doesn't make me feel any better about cops.
Robin, the RUC officer who's now in the PSNI, he works here in Derry, and I'd never met him before. And then, of course, Taya was masterful in organising that the two of us met before we met all 6 of us as a group. And we met in the barracks. And he then told me that he'd been in Oma shortly after the bomb. So he was charged with body recovery. And I was 15 at the time of the bomb. And my father was working at that time. And he wasn't stationed in Oma. He had been previously, but because he was older and nearing retirement, he was stationed out in a village outside of Oma. And so he was called in. On that day, they received a call saying, there's a device in Oma and we need everybody in. So he was in the car with other guys coming into Oma at the time that it exploded. He was terrified. He thought he'd lost all of us, because it was a Saturday afternoon, shopping, August. And in fact, when he got there, there were already sheets that had been placed over the bodies of those who died. And he went around and lifted the sheets, looking for us. And then eventually, a few hours later, we found him and he found us.
But then the call came in for Oma. A huge bomb in a busy Saturday street in a wee town most of the world had never heard of. I was off. It was my son Christopher's birthday. I got the call and had to just get up and go. There is no way to describe the horror. Babies, foreign visitors, a pregnant mother, young men and women, an officer's child, all snuffed out in the most grotesque ways. Endless clearing up. 2 weeks of body identification, trying to ID the dead and make them presentable to their loved ones. That second night, as we left, a group of people had gathered in the park for a spontaneous prayer service. They applauded as police walked by. I wanted to scream, "Why are you clapping for us? We didn't fix anything. We can't bring anyone back from the dead." Every morning at 3 a.m. I'd awaken. Am I asleep or dreaming? My eyes are open, but I can't move. I see a baby crawling on the ceiling. But the baby has the face of one of the Oma dead. I get up and run a triathlon every day. I wanted to take my own life. I didn't see my marriage falling apart. I didn't see my sanity slipping away.
So I hadn't met Robin until then. And then as for James, who was in the UDA as a teenager, that was a whole new experience because I don't know anybody from his background like that. And what was so strong were the relationships that were established in the, across the generations, because there was that strong sense that finally we, who were all in our 20s, were being listened to by the older generation, because the older generation very much feel that they're carrying it all and they've wanted to protect us, their children, their nieces, their nephews, children of friends. They've wanted to keep all of that away from us. But the fact was, we grew up in it. I was born in 1983. My father joined the police the year I was born because he'd lost his job at a factory. So he joined the same year I was born, and there's a photograph of me in his RUC uniform, aged 4. And of course, it was just because it was my father's, and I'm a total daddy's girl, and I looked up and loved it and adore him and still do, and he was there. And so the whole thing was like, I want to try on your boots. So here's me at the age of 4 trying on these boots that come up right to my thigh, you know. And I had the whole bit on, except obviously for the bulletproof vest, because that would have floored me. That was normal, and it was normal to look under the car for bombs. And I'm partially sighted, and of course the whole joke was, well, my daddy did it, so I did it. I didn't know what I was looking for. I just did what my daddy did, not knowing that, you know, not everybody did that in the morning before they drove off. And daddy was working ridiculous hours, 16, 18-hour shifts at times, and we wanted him home. But mummy, of course, wouldn't have said that she was worried sick. But, and you didn't have mobile phones then, so she was just trying to keep us calm, and daddy'll be home, and whatever, but, you know, that's what was going on at the time. And as I got older, I was listening to the radio, I was listening to the news. And, you know, 2 police officers were shot in Lurgan in 1990. And I knew, my daddy is a police officer. Does that mean my daddy's going to get shot? And I was, from the age of 5, I was aware that there were people who wanted to kill my daddy. So, to finally have the opportunity to be heard was very, very significant. I described it as a rite of passage, and that's why. Because it was the first opportunity, and I was 26 at the time, but it was the first opportunity when the older generation listened and actually heard what we were saying.
Some of the reflections from the young audience members was that this was for the first time in their young lives, their teenage lives, that they got to understand what happened. They learnt more about their history, their contemporary history of the last 30 years, during their young lives, that they understood more. So the power of theatre, because you can go into a room and you can tell a story, but to make a theatrical production, to put something on stage, and then it has the lighting, we commissioned a composer to write the music, it sort of lifts it up and makes the voices more powerful and I think more meaningful. And they really, there's an energy in the theatre or the community hall that there's a connection. Because this is about us. This is about us in the north of Ireland, within the island of Ireland. And everybody was affected, you know. Everybody was affected. Some of the statistics that are coming out now are amazing, the amount of people whose lives were touched. And we're not just talking the 40,000 people who were injured or hurt, or upwards of 4,000 people who were killed and lost their lives. So it was hard to grow up here with the conflict and not be affected by it.
The performance opened the way for Victoria's family to speak about events and experiences they had kept to themselves for years.
My parents are phenomenal. They're incredibly supportive, and they trusted that I wouldn't do anything that would hurt them or shame them or embarrass them or exploit them or put them in jeopardy in any way. It allowed them to share, you know, because part of the generational thing is that one generation passes on to the next generation the stories of our shared history, of our histories. And they had edited that because they wanted to protect us. And so it basically allowed them to see that I was old enough to hear it and old enough to deal with it and that I knew rightly a lot of what was going on. And if I didn't, I knew the context. So it wasn't as shocking as they may have thought and as it would have been a few years before. But again, like I said earlier, Derry was my education because it wasn't until I came here, and I was 23, you know. But history classes at school don't teach you anything that's relevant to now. You know, they give you a bit. My Irish history stopped circa 1937, and I had no context as to why what was happening was happening. I didn't know about the civil rights movement, nothing about it. I didn't know about the Battle of the Bogside. I didn't know that the majority of the police force at that time was Protestant and that there was discrimination widespread. I didn't know that Catholics in Derry couldn't get a house. I didn't know that when my parents got married in 1978, my mother was Catholic, my father was Protestant. There were people who didn't come to the wedding because my father had family who didn't come to the wedding because he was marrying a Catholic. The priest that my mother asked to marry them wouldn't marry them because she was marrying a Protestant. I didn't know that that was what was going on. And this allowed us to talk about those things and to share, you know, family, intimate family things that were so important, but that, you know, hadn't been shared.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things I want to say. Say them loud and say them clear for the whole wide world to hear.
Victoria, how do you think that young people like yourself are coping with the legacy of the conflict?
Honestly, not very well. I think part of the reason that you have crowds of teenagers, and I mean 15-year-olds and younger, on those city walls here in Derry, drinking themselves into oblivion, is because no one listens. Because, again, their parents are still suffering. Their parents are still carrying the weight of what they've been carrying. And it is a weight. It's an emotional burden. And as you know, with particularly in Irish society all over, people have a tendency not to talk about the serious stuff.
I am the ripple effect. I don't even know what that means. I want to get away from this place. There's nothing here for me. I'm not interested in hearing anything more about the Troubles. That's the past, their past. We're the future. Alcohol, prejudice, fighting, curbs with red, white and blue, curbs with green, white and orange, a flag in the middle, murals on the electric box, the IRA with balaclavas and guns where little kids play with their toys, Lurgan tonic wine, a buck fast bottle, meth for lights, burning resin, fighting till heads are busted in, faces blue and black, teeth knocked out. I have a reputation to defend. Defend my crew. Getting tense when I see the Union Jack. Warm when I see green, white and orange. I get scared of the prejudice I see in my head. Who taught me this anyway? Can I make it go away? You're drunk, you're stoned. He stabbed. Friends steal cars. White fan in flames. Burnt out images on the TV. Get a buzz, get a high. Bike to Legahory for a 15 lump. Bunk school, play guitar. Diary entry. Pills, mushrooms, coke, blow, roll it and smoke it, snort it and swallow it, hide the remains. Driving drunk, driving stoned, getting caught, do it again, tiptoe upstairs, sleep it off. Is this all there is?
Audiences didn't leave the theatre after these performances. They sat. It was like they were given permission to speak. And for many of the audience members, it was the first time they spoke of their story or their particular trauma. The feedback, the reflections we got, I suppose really it struck home to us that this type of theatre is needed to help reconciliation and to help the healing from the hurt.
one of the major insights I got was just how powerful the arts can be. And it really opened my eyes to what theatre can be and what the arts can be and how huge an impact arts can have. And my mother was a music and drama teacher. I grew up surrounded by that, but never appreciated the potential that it had to really create community, because it's a communal experience, but also then to communicate ideas, to share ideas, to create a space for discussion, reflection, exploration. I mean, people in the audience, it was free to go. And some nights, I mean, in Oma we played to a packed house because my mother told everybody she knew, and so there were 300 in the theatre, and I was on stage talking about the Oma bomb that had exploded. What, like, a two-minute walk away from the theatre we were in? And there were people in the audience who were saying, what's she talking about that for now? Sure, isn't that all done? And look, we've heard enough of that. But there was a woman there, a friend of my mother's, whose daughter was killed in the bomb. And when my mother asked, so what did you think of it? She said, do you know, it was the truth. And we don't get to hear that very often.
Well, I wish I could fly like a bird in the sky. Oh, how sweet it would be if I found that I could fly. Well, I'd soar to the sun and look down at the sea. And I'd sing, 'cause I'd know, yes, I'd sing.